Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court. Johnny Johnson has a mental disability. In this state, we don't kill people who have mental disabilities. The jury heard, and it is proven beyond a reasonable doubt, that Johnny has a mental disease. There is no doubt that he has a mental disease. It is the worst mental disease that a person can have. The chemicals in his brain do not work correctly. But they did not hear half of the story, the half that Johnny has a mental defect. In Section 552, the legislature separated out mental disease from mental defect. It is not the same. It is not the same. His mental defect is brain damage. His brain just does not work. Neuroscience, how is it different from the psychologist? The state says, well, they hired psychologist after psychologist. Neuroscience is different. Neuroscience has scientific measures. It is objective. It is reproducible. We can bring in 100 neuropsychologists to do the exact same test, and 100 of them should come up with the same results. It is not a soft thing.
Have defendants been acquitted on this testimony?
I'm sorry?
Have defendants been acquitted on this neuroscience testimony?
I believe they have, Your Honor. And additionally...
What sort of scan is used to justify the diagnosis that you're claiming that he has?
What sort of...
What is the test?
There were 15 tests done, and Dr. Beaver.
What's the type of test that you say objectively demonstrates that he has this diagnosis?
Well, in at the end of our, I think it's somewhere in, Exhibit 12 or 13. You have the actual testing data.
Is it a brain scan or is it question and answer type test that you're talking about?
Some of them are question and answer type tests. Some of them are actual performance type tests. But there were 15 of them done. Right. Now,
even on the performance type test, the experts disagree as to what they show and don't show.
No, the experts don't disagree on it. Dr. Delaney Dean did not do neuroscientific testing. Okay, she is a psychologist. She administered the Stroop test, okay, which is a gross test for measuring executive functioning. It is one of some 30-odd available neuroscientific tests. She told the lawyers at the very beginning, I am not a neuropsychologist, go get one. So did their other expert, Dr. Draper, who was looking at Johnny's development as a child. Okay? Did they reasonably know? Yes. Because they knew that he had 3 head injuries as a child. He was dropped onto an iron stove. He fell out of a bunk bed, hitting his head. I forget what the third one was, but there were also 2 when he was an adolescent. So could they reasonably, through their own investigation, know to hire a neuropsychologist? Yes. Because the evidence was there. Could they reasonably have known to hire a neuropsychologist because their doctors told them to? Their experts who were looking at Johnny's mind? Yes. They did reasonably know that they should do this.
To rule as you're asking us to rule, would we have to overrule recent cases? Haven't we just ruled that it's not ineffective assistance of counsel to not hire one type of expert, that it can be reasonable trial strategy?
Well, no, I don't think you have to overrule any recent case law. First, we're talking about the Lyons case, correct? The Lyons case, they had 2 doctors who said, don't hire a neuropsychologist. He doesn't have any brain damage.
And I'm sorry, I apologize that the name of the case is
Andrew Lyons.
My brain, but I don't think it's the Lyons case. It was a within the last year.
Well, what you have to do is look at it on a case-by-case basis, because what did the lawyers reasonably know through their own investigation? Neuropsychology is different because it is objective, scientific, and reproducible. But also, they had to reasonably know they should go down that avenue. The brain injuries that Johnny suffered and the their people, their experts themselves said, go do this. And did they have a reasonable reason for not doing it? No. The motion court gave them a reasonable reason, but the motion court did that by disregarding what the lawyer said.
Didn't they say they didn't recall?
They said, if we had a strategic reason, we would have written it down. We did not have a strategic reason. Each of them said that we did not have a strategic reason for not doing this. It should have been done. They even started looking for a neuropsychologist, but then just dropped the ball.
Well, you're indicating this is a hard science versus soft science. Is there any indication that everyone with this kind of a defect would commit a murder? What's the causal relationship? This brain abnormality and murder?
Well, I don't think that you can say everybody in a particular class of people does a certain thing. For example, when we talk about mental retardation, we don't say every single mentally retarded person is going to go out and commit murder. Every single child is going to go out and commit murder. We look at them on a case-by-case basis.
So you're saying this mental defect eliminates the mens rea?
Does it eliminate the mens rea? We have testimony that Johnny could not deliberate at the time of the crime.
You did not. This was not a complete defense, but you're saying it negated deliberation?
Correct. It indicated he was psychotic at the time. He had the feeling of bugs crawling under his skin. He was seeing shadow people. He was listening to demons. All that was presented. However, half of the story was left out, the half about the brain damage. Now, what's the prejudice? The prejudice is that the state turned this on Johnny. They turned his mental disease on him. Okay? They said, okay, Johnny, this Dr. English said, Johnny liked hallucinating. He liked being delusional. He sought that out through street drugs, through his own volition, not taking his prescribed medication.
Going back to Judge Teitelman's question, is there scientific evidence that explains the impact of the brain damage as he has on behavior?
Are there scientific studies of his brain damage?
Brain damage in general that ties it to particular
actions. Uh-huh. Well, I don't think there's studies exactly on that point. However, as Dr. Beaver said, you cannot separate Johnny's brain damage from his mental illness because it's all going on up there at the same time. The chemicals in his brain are not functioning correctly. That's the disease, causing him not to see reality in the way that we do. On the other hand, his brain physically does not look like a normal person's brain because it's damaged.
I asked that question because we have a prior decision probably 4 years ago, and at that time there was no science that tied brain damage to behavior.
Or specific damage to a specific area of the brain to specific
right.
behavior.
Well, I agree that that neuroscience is a young science, but the fact that there are not specific cases where we can cite to this part of the brain being damaged does this.
The reason I ask, because in that case it was found that the neuroscience evidence was admissible only in the punishment phase rather than in the guilt phase. So I was asking, one, what the evidence, I didn't clearly ask, what the evidence was at trial and whether there is scientific evidence that it would be a causal factor, as Judge Teitelman asked.
Well, we don't have scientific evidence saying X causes Y. We do know that Johnny's brain was not functioning correctly on the day in question, that he was floridly psychotic, that he he was hearing voices, he was having command hallucinations, and whether that is a function of his mental...
And all that evidence was presented to the jury in the sense of what his symptoms were, if you will.
What his symptoms were.
As I understand, your argument is counsel was ineffective because only part of the cause of those symptoms was considered by the jury.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes, only part of it. And that the fact that the state turned that around on Johnny and made it his fault that he was hallucinating, you cannot do that with brain injury.
Doesn't the state often use this type of evidence in not only death penalty cases but other cases regarding in the guilt phase and also in the punishment phase?
You mean don't they often say ignore the
well, or they say this is a reason to be afraid of this person because they go off their medication, they do this, they do that. This is a reason to be afraid of them. I mean, I understand your thought process is that it's a mitigating factor, but also it might be an aggravating factor.
To put on something that a doctor to say that Johnny's brain does not work right and it's not his fault. It's not his fault that he was dropped on a stove when he was a child. It's not his fault that he hit his head falling out of a bunk bed. It's not his fault that he was beaten up as an adolescent and it suffered head injuries. That has to be mitigating. That has to be a reason not to give him death. The volitional aspect of he's not taking his psychotropic medications, but he's taking street drugs instead, that gives him more of, to a jury, it gives him more of a culpability. But brain damage does not give him culpability.
Is there any testimony? I know doctors can't say damage to this part of the brain causes this behavior, causes you not to be able to deliberate. Was there any testimony saying it could or it may have an effect? Or I mean, because how do we know it has any relationship, or how could the jury determine that?
How could the jury determine whether brain damage had causal effect of homicide?
Not that that's the issue, but you're saying, well, they should consider that this affected his ability to deliberate, his ability to control himself. I understand that the science may be young and there's no direct causal relationship, but why wouldn't you need some sort of expert testimony saying that he has this definite brain damage, all our studies show he has this, and while we can't say exactly the causal mechanism, this may well have affected his ability to deliberate or to whatever it is. Otherwise, how is it not simply, how is it related? Why should the jury consider it? You're saying it's not volitional, but how do we know that?
It's just, how do we know that?
That it affected his ability to.
Well, by the testimony of Dr. Beaver.
So what did that's what I'm asking. What did the doctor say to connect those?
Well, he said that on the day in question, Johnny was floridly psychotic and he had the brain damage. Okay, so and those two things could not be separated.
And he said you can't separate those.
No.
Okay.
But that's
and all of that affected his ability to deliberate.
That's why he wanted to bring the expert. He thought the defense attorney should have brought the expert in to make that connection.
Right, to make that very connection.
And what would the expert have said? I'm asking, what did you show the expert would have said to make that connection?
In his testimony, he said, look, it's not a situation where you can say, okay, brain damage caused homicide.
But what did he say brain damage could do?
He said the brain damage interfered with his ability to deliberate.
Okay, he said
and that it was a mitigating factor.
He said it interfered with his ability to deliberate?
Yes.
Or something
yes.
comparable
yeah,
to that,
not deliberate at the time.
Language.
Yeah. Yes.
And did he have, rather than just reaching that conclusion, did he have some additional testimony that supported that conclusion?
Yes, he did a series of a battery of 15 neuroscience tests on him. I'm sorry.
Now, in the Bible, Abraham heard voices that said, kill your son.
Yes, okay.
Now, if he had done that, then he would have been, the demons would have told, or the demons, the voices would have said, kill your son Isaac. Did the demons in this case say murderous, rape and murder a six-year-old?
Your Honor, I don't know that. I really don't. Johnny was floridly psychotic at the time he was arrested. He was floridly psychotic throughout the time that he confessed to the crimes. And he was so dulled down by misapplied psychotropic drugs at the time of his trial that he was not able to speak to this. Even in his medicated state right now, Johnny is still hearing voices.
But he was not held incompetent to assist his attorneys or
no, he was not.
What was brought out in cross-examination to regarding Dr. English's testimony that he enjoyed the voices, he could control the voices, he didn't appear to act on them, and that somehow made them different?
What was brought out by the trial attorneys in cross-examination? Not much.
That's rather unusual testimony.
I believe that is rather unusual testimony. Not much was brought out, and it was not properly rebutted in this case, and that is also one of the issues in this case. I see I'm way out of time. I would ask you not to kill Johnny. Thank you.
Thank you.
This case is not about killing an individual who suffers from a mental disability.
Could you speak up?
This case, may it please the court. I apologize.
That's okay. Just speak in the microphone.
May it please the court.
That's better.
I apologize. Thank you, Your Honor. This case is not about killing a person who has a mental disability or mental defect. This case is about whether Mr. Johnson's attorneys were ineffective in representing him at trial. If there's a question as to Mr. Johnson's competence at some future point to have this lawful judgment carried out, that can be litigated in an appropriate place.
Do you know of any case in which this expert testified and the person was acquitted?
I do not, Your Honor. And with regard to Dr. Beaver's testimony, I think I should make clear that my reading of his testimony, at no point did Dr. Beaver testify that the brain damage that he allegedly discovered affected Mr. Johnson's ability to deliberate. The testimony that he gave was far more limited.
Pardon me.
He offered testimony along the lines that brain damage along these lines could affect somebody's thought process to the extent that it might slow down the way that they process information. But at no point did he say this brain damage made him incapable of deliberation. And that's the key here. The expert that the defense attorneys decided to call in this case, after a thorough investigation of his background, his mental condition, his family life, That expert, the one who testified at trial, was able to provide a defense, a diminished capacity defense, wherein she said he was incapable of deliberating at the time of the murders. Dr. Beaver simply couldn't do that.
Wouldn't this testimony certainly have helped, though, if they had had this additional evidence of the brain damage for the jury to consider?
In some respects, it could have corroborated some of the testimony offered by Dr. Dean in terms of explaining, corroborating that he was low, a low intellectual functioning individual or lower, average to low. It could have corroborated some of that. But what it really would have done, but there was plenty of evidence along those lines. There was really no dispute about that. There was plenty of evidence that he wasn't the brightest person, that his intellectual capacity was average to low.
But there are standards for that, given the Jenkins case. So that was before the court.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For the jury. But the issue of, now it doesn't have to be within a reasonable medical certainty, because it's beyond a reasonable doubt, could this testimony from a psychiatrist, a scientist, not saying psychologists aren't scientists too, and very able people, but an actual scientist who does scientific tests, that he had did not have the capacity but to deliberate or to have the appropriate mens rea to murder this child?
Had Dr. Beaver been able to offer testimony along those lines, I think that the defendant's argument or the movement's argument in this case would have much more force. But Dr. Beaver couldn't offer that testimony.
What particular brain scans, if any, was Dr. Beaver relying on?
None.
So oftentimes when this type of evidence is presented concerning brain damage, there's objective, there's three or four different scans that are used to prove it. But even at this date, they haven't offered any of that type of evidence, have they?
That's correct. And Dr. Beaver's testimony was not objective scientific evidence in the sense that if they had hired
a neurosurgeon who did those types of tests and those objective tests indicated that there wasn't any brain damage, what would they be stuck with? What if they did? I mean, if they went to a neuroscience who did a neurological doctor who performed testing as opposed to various scans and things that we sometimes see in these types of cases, and it indicated that there was no brain damage. To this date, in this case, do we have any neurosurgeon who's done any scans who's verified any physiological brain damage?
But we do not have any such evidence.
Does the state contest that there's brain damage, or contest the connection, or both?
I wouldn't concede that there is brain damage, because I'm not sure that the motion court credited Dr. Beaver's testimony in terms of its effectiveness in ferreting out brain damage, because the tests that he applied really were subjective tests, or could be subjectively manipulated by the defendant, since they were question and answer and performance tests performed by the defendant. It might be a little bit different case, for example, that these tests might gain greater objectivity if Dr. Beaver went in and then another doctor went in and they were blind to each other's results and they both produced similar results on the inventories these neuropsychological inventories, but nothing like that happened. So all we have is one set of tests performed in a setting where the defendant knows he's already been convicted, he knows why the doctor's there, and he can subjectively manipulate those tests.
What about the issue of failure to investigate, failure to follow up, when Dr. Dean said you really need to get this kind of expert and they did not get one?
Well, I don't think that the record really supports the narrative that's been set forth by the movement. The motion court found that the way this went down, and I think this is backed up by the testimony of the attorneys and the experts at the evidentiary hearing as well, is that Dr. Draper was the first person to suggest the possibility that they might need some neuropsychological testing. The attorneys then said, all right, we'll talk to Dr. Dean about that. They talked to Dr. Dean about that. She said, well, that might be a good idea. I think she may have provided a name of a neuropsychologist that they could contact. They wrote that down. And then after that, Dr. Dean meets with Mr. Johnson two more times, continues to evaluate them, and then she issues her report, wherein she indicates that she's done a number of tests, including the Stroop neuropsychological test, and her testing reveals that there's no substantial evidence or reason to believe that he suffers from brain damage.
But she's a psychologist.
That's true.
And she offered a name, someone who's a neuropsychologist, and this is a capital murder case. I were looking at ineffective assistance of the counsel, how far do we need to get? What's the standard for the defense attorney to say, well, I better follow up on this. This person gives his name, I better make sure it's right.
I would think that there might be a greater obligation on counsel if Dr. Dean's report had come back and said, you know, I did a neuropsychological test. It didn't show much, but, you know, I don't really know enough about this, and so you better go and talk to somebody else. That's not what the evidence shows. Her report simply indicated that there was no substantial or significant evidence of brain damage.
But she offered a name of someone else
earlier.
Neuropsychologist further that might be helpful in the case.
Right, and earlier they had those discussions. But once she comes back and gives her written formal opinion, I have to believe, and counsel indicated that they relied on that report and that they continued to have discussions about who they were going to call. Now, the motion court determined that while counsel could not remember the reason why they decided not to call that doctor, that there was an indication in the record that explained why they decided not to call that doctor.
Opposing counsel says that defense counsel said if there had been a reason, we would have had it written, so you can infer from silence.
I don't think that their testimony was that clear either. The testimony was that she had not written the reason in her memo, but I don't think that the fact that she failed to write it, I don't think she connected that and said, I write everything, and if it's not written there, I didn't have a reason. What she ultimately said was, pardon me, I cannot recall, and the word she used was recall, I cannot recall the strategic reason. She said, quote, I just don't remember going through that process and deciding whether it would be valuable or important to do neuropsych testing. Now, the fact that she doesn't recall doesn't prove that she didn't have a reason or that she suddenly abandoned her duties as an experienced capital litigation attorney. In fact, earlier she said, look, I've considered putting on this kind of testimony before. I've put it on before. On cross-examination she said that. Not earlier, but on cross-examination she admitted, yeah, look, I've done this before. I've put it on before. She wasn't an inexperienced capital litigation attorney. So the reasonable inference that I think the motion court drew is that once the expert's testimony or formal report came back and said there's no substantial evidence of brain damage, that they concluded, well, we're not going to continue to beat that bush. We're not going to go down that road because we're not getting anywhere, and we already have an expert on hand who we think is going to be a very credible expert because, well, for instance, she was a former prosecutor. She comes across very well. And she's going to actually give him a defense. Now, of diminished capacity. Now,
do we have any evidence, any offer of proof that the brain damage was a certain part of the... Certain brain damage might affect motor skills.
No,
certain brain damage might affect memory. There's enough science in those areas. Is there any evidence whatsoever where the brain damage would have been or was or could be?
I've read in cases before, Your Honor, that, you know, for example, damage to the frontal lobe can affect executive functioning and decision-making and those sorts of things. But Dr. Beaver didn't offer any testimony specifically identifying an area of the brain that was damaged in this case.
There was a statement by your opponent, by Mr. Lund, who said this is a new science. And we are looking at 2005 when the trial occurred, is that right, and these decisions were made. When she was testifying that she was aware of this testimony and she presented it, was it in the time frame of 2005? Because obviously this is a growing...
Right.
This is a developing science, but also the use of it in capital cases has been evolving. And so where were we when they were making the decision in 2005 versus the time of the post-conviction hearing?
I don't think there was any evidence in that along those lines at this evidentiary hearing. I will say that The counsel admitted on cross-examination that she had presented such testimony before. So it's probably reasonable to conclude that it was at least a class of evidence that was being considered as potentially useful among members of the defense bar.
She
and
said that
bar.
At that time she had already used it, or is it later? We're not sure.
Your Honor, I don't think that the testimony reveals that she said that at the time she had used it previously. But at the evidentiary hearing this go around, by the point of that hearing, she had done it before.
Did she say whether, gosh, as a competent attorney, I should have done this? Or
no, I don't think she did. Although I think she, one of the two attorneys, may have said something along the lines of, well, yeah, it might be good to have a full battery of tests as opposed to just, you know, the Stroop neurological test that our one expert did. But here's the thing. That expert who did the Stroop neurological test, there was no evidence that she was not qualified to perform that test. And frankly, I would think that many experts in the field of psychology, psychiatry, would probably be able to run an inventory test along those lines, because that's what it is. It's seeing the responses by the defendant, timing him on performance tests, those sorts of things. And there was no evidence that she wasn't trained in the Stroop, that she was not qualified to do the Stroop, and that counsel should therefore not have relied on her evaluation of the Stroop neurological test in deciding, hey, maybe that's not a road that we should waste additional resources on. Now, you know, the decision, I mean, the trial was in 2005. The decision to go after a particular expert would have been made 2004, 2003, you know, sometime after they got involved in the case. So we're talking about a decision that was made, you know, 8-9 years ago. But it was made not after stinting efforts to determine this defendant's mental condition, his mental defect, or whatever he may have. He had been evaluated by two state's experts. He'd been evaluated by Dr. Rabun, I'm not sure how to pronounce that name, I apologize. They obtained additional evaluations. He'd been found competent. They had talked to other sorts of experts, Dr. Draper. They ended up calling four experts in the guilt phase. This is not a case where counsel said, you know, we talked to somebody on the phone, that's good enough. No. They had a mitigation specialist. They investigated 66 witnesses. They looked at family history. They looked at educational history. They looked at his mental history. They looked at thousands of pages of medical records and mental health records. They provided all of those pages to their experts. They gave their experts a full picture to consider in determining whether this defendant suffered from mental disease or defect. And not one of them said in a formal report, you need to go and check brain damage. In fact, their expert said, I did a Stroop neurological test in addition to all of her other evaluation, and I don't see any substantial evidence of brain damage in this case. I think under those circumstances, counsel is not ineffective for making the decision to say, all right, we have a certain amount of resources in this case. Where are we going to expend those to best represent our defendants?
How much should that be a consideration in a death penalty case? Let's say it's a public defender and they don't have a lot of money. Well, we only have a budget of $50,000, and this would cost an extra $5,000. How far can they go on that without being ineffective?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question, but I assume that there are policies in place in the public defender system to make an request for additional appropriation if counsel finds that there is some expert or some avenue that needs to be pursued. I suspect that Mr. Lunt would have a better answer to your question there, but I have to believe that they...
If that's denied, could that be prima facie a case of ineffective assistance if the public defenders, we don't have the money to pay for that?
No, I would think not, because the practical reality is that there are limitations to any representation. I don't think that we have to say every defendant gets $100 million to defend a case.
At least according to the count.
I agree. I think that there's a baseline of adequate representation. I don't think that we can apply a certain sum of money to it in any given case or for any particular defendant.
Would that be relevant to the jurisprudence to know that someone they wanted the actual trial attorney wanted the performance test, and the public defender says we can't afford it and you don't have it, and then the person they don't have it for the defense.
Well, Your Honor, I would think that that probably happens in many cases, that money runs out, and I'm not sure that
so should life and death be determined by how much money you have to spend on your defense?
Well, it may be, I would think that, you know, that might be a question that would gain greater significance in a death penalty case
is that issue presented in this case at all by any party?
It is not. There's no evidence or indication in the record that there was any shortage of funds for the public defenders involved in this case. He had two attorneys in this case. He had support staff who were supporting those attorneys, and it doesn't appear to be any indication of a lack of funds. But if that were to arise in a case, I would think that it would
support
require...
Support staff may cost less than an expert.
Pardon me?
Getting an expert who might be new to the field or a new science might cost a little more than the support staff would.
It might. I would think that paying an expert... $300 or $400 an hour to do their evaluation or whatever it is they charge these days, and then to come in and testify and to travel and all those sorts of things would be a little more expensive.
Was there any indication here they asked for permission to hire another expert and it was refused?
No. Okay. No indication along those lines. What it appears and what the motion court found is that the attorneys had thoroughly looked at this potential area. They had found an expert that satisfied their need of presenting a defense of diminished capacity. They decided they would go with that expert, and they ultimately opted, based on information in the report that there was no substantial evidence of brain damage, to say neuropsychological testing isn't necessary in this case and won't gain as much benefit. And they were right, because the neuropsychologist who came in and testified at the post-conviction hearing, he really didn't provide much. He couldn't say that there was no deliberation. All he could talk about were perhaps slowed mental functioning, low intellect, all of which were facts that were brought out of the trial. What he could have provided, perhaps, was an additional label additional clinical term to explain what was being viewed in Mr. Johnson's lower intellect or slower thought processes. And to suggest that he was prejudiced because, well, gee, you know, the state really attacked Dr. Dean, but Dr. Beaver wouldn't have been subject to the same attack. Well, not the exact same attack, but he certainly would have been subject to attack. Even Dr. Beaver admitted that chronic drug use is going to exacerbate the problems, is going to make the brain damage worse, and Mr. Johnson was voluntarily ingesting drugs. So the state could have very well said, look, he's responsible for a lot of that too. Don't listen to it. The state could have made similar arguments. They could have attacked Dr. Beaver in many of the same ways. And going back to one earlier point, which was, should counsel have known with this new science to go and get this sort of expert? I think that they probably could have contemplated this expert. But one thing they couldn't have done was presented the testimony that Dr. Beaver actually presented at the post-conviction hearing, because he based his testimony on information that wasn't extant at the time of trial. And so it takes on an additional, I see that I'm out of time, if I may finish this one thought.
Yes, please do, sir.
There's an additional problem here, which is that we have to reconstruct what it looked like at the time of trial. And so Dr. Beaver really should have limited his testimony to information that would have been available at the time of trial and coming up with his opinions. And that goes for all the experts who testified at post-conviction hearing.
So let's say at the time of trial, and following Judge Becker, which is great questions, the science hasn't developed, but 5 years later, the science is much more developed, much more accepted. We wouldn't be able to use that science to look back and say whether or not the person had a sufficient... an example would be the Atkins case.
Right.
15 years before, the Supreme Court said, no, you can execute mentally retarded people, but then statutes were passed and it became more unusual, and the Supreme Court reversed itself only 15 years later.
And you could use that science in a hypothetical discussion of whether the defendant was prejudiced, but you couldn't use that newly advanced science to say that counsel, at the time they made their decision, made an unreasonable decision, because that decision has to be viewed in the light that it would have been viewed at the time counsel made that decision. They're not required to be clairvoyant about advances in science, about new evidence that might be discovered, or anything like that. They have to make their decision based on what's available then. But as in terms of a hypothetical prejudice discussion, sure, you could look at that. And if there were something along those lines that showed new evidence that showed that he suffered from a condition that rendered him incompetent and that we couldn't discover that earlier, that certainly that would be something that could be raised in an appropriate time to stop an execution of an incompetent individual.
Were any of the 15 tests physical tests?
I believe some of them involved him writing and completing things. I don't know if they involved physical tests such as, you know, moving, you know, rings from one post to another. I've seen those sorts of tests. It may have been that some of the neuropsychological tests involved physical movement of objects or arrangement of objects into patterns and things like that. I don't recall. I apologize, Your Honor. I went over my notes about those tests, and I just have a recollection that some of them may have involved some physical movement or use of objects, manipulation of objects. Thank you,
but
Your
no
Honor.
Brain scans where they could look at the brain scans. And say this is an injury that would cause that person to do this conduct.
Right. No scans. Just those sorts of things. Which, as everybody knows, if somebody is aware that they need to fail a test. And he could go as slow as he wants.
Dr. Butler testified he was aware of his Mr. Johnson's history of malingering on psychological tests. Can you tell us what that evidence was?
As I recall, there was that was just a finding in one of the earlier reports that there was some malingering, or at least, and I think. There was one finding of malingering. There were multiple findings by some of the doctors, including some of the doctors of the post-conviction hearing, that he had a tendency to exaggerate symptoms when he was talking about them. But those doctors...
That's all subjective observation
is.
By the doctor. And malingering is in the eyes of the beholder.
Well, I think that they're similar in but perhaps describe the same sort of thing to different degrees. Malingering would be, I think, more a conscious, you know, fakery, you know, trying to fake symptoms that are not there. Exaggeration, on the other hand, as some of the doctors indicated that they observed, would mean that the symptoms are there, but he's exaggerating them in an attempt to sort of make his point and persuade. And so in some cases, the doctors said, well, that exaggeration didn't really affect my diagnosis because I still think he had the symptoms. He was just exaggerating what he said. But that would be a matter of degree. One doctor might look at that and say he's exaggerating. One doctor might look at it and say, no, he's making it up. He's malingering.
Many of the tests have some built-in mechanism to detect whether there's malingering.
They do, and Dr. Beaver testified that he performed validity testing and that he believed that his tests were valid.
Right. So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, neuroscience is not a brand new science. The ABA guidelines.
Now, what do you have physically in hard science that shows where the brain was damaged and how that might affect their...
You mean, do we have a photograph that shows part of Johnny's brain is blank or
did
absent?
Or do the test show it was a damage to a certain area of the frontal lobe or to some other particular
area?
The test show...
MRI or...
There is no MRI here.
There is no...
The scans that we have are not advanced enough to show you exactly where Johnny's brain is malfunctioning.
Well, I mean, do you have any at all?
Do we have any at all? No, we do not.
So to this date?
To this day, we do not have a scan that says Johnny's brain has a hole right here.
Not that you have one that says that. I mean, has one even been performed?
No, one has not been performed at this point.
Why not?
Why not? Because brain scans and PET scans are such large areas. If he had a railroad spike like Phineas Gage through his head, a brain scan would show that. However, when you live a lifetime and you have a series of head injuries, your brain
But if you've been lobotomized, brain scan would show that.
If he had had a huge gross brain damage where part of his brain had actually died, yeah, there would be a scan that would show that. But that's not how neuroscience has advanced yet. Okay. In 2003, the ABA guidelines said lawyers have to look at medical history, illness or injury, alcohol and drug use, prenatal and birth trauma, malnutrition, developmental delays, and neurological damage. 2003, we knew you have to look at neurological damage.
Do we know some drugs cause brain damage? They actually cause organic damage to parts of the brain. Right. Do we know what drugs he used or what effect?
Well, we know that his brother and sister got hooked on crack, and we know that his brother and sister had him use meth at one point. And he did use other drugs like marijuana and things like that. Johnny.
But people were convicted of murder on marijuana, meth, and crack.
Oh, sure. But. The actual etiology, where the brain damage came from, doesn't matter if the brain doesn't work.
Well, as I understood, what I thought was your primary argument is that the jury might have given this sort of testimony more credence than the testimony that they were offered. That's the prejudice. And so my question is, well, without these objective tests, without these scans, why would the jury give this type of testimony any more weight than the testimony was given? Because it is presented with no more objective testing than the testing that was done by the psychiatrist who said there's no substantial brain injury. In other words, if one says, well, yes, there is, and one says, no, there isn't, and one says, well, I've got a scan, I can show you.
Well, if the court would get to the
prejudice analysis, and there are no objective indications of brain damage, again, we're just relying on various competing experts' testimony.
There are no competing experts here, Your Honor. There is no evidence that Johnny's brain works fine. There's no evidence presented. The state had the opportunity to present a neuropsychologist who said, Johnny's brain works fine, but there's no evidence before the court of that.
But you're saying there's no competing neuroscientists. So.
Right.
Well, I mean,
generally,
don't rebut evidence that isn't there. So, in other words, I assume that they assumed that they were getting competently represented, and there was this psychological testimony and explanation for the symptoms, and so they presented evidence to rebut that.
Correct.
If there had been any neurological type testimony, we could expect them to try to rebut that.
They had the opportunity during the PCR to do that.
Certainly you would admit that there were PET scans, MRIs, and CAT scans available in 2005.
They are out there.
And that they were being used in these types of cases.
Those PET scans and things are out there. But to say that the battery of 15 tests are not objective tests, they are scientifically studied, these tests. They are weighted. They have validity measures. The tests in this case were put through a computer and validity measured. Johnny did not malinger any of these things. In addition, the Stroop test, Johnny failed that test for Dr. Dean. And she said, well, it's probably because he's of his low intellectual functioning. She said, go get a neuropsychological battery, and they did not.
Is that because of cost? Do you have a limitation?
There is no issue of cost in this case, Your Honor. The reason being is because death is different. The public defender system will provide the tests that are needed, the doctors who are needed for an examination. They had every reason to believe that neuropsychological examination was needed in this case, and they just didn't do it. They did not make a strategic reason.
Mr. McElprang says that the report filed had contrary information about whether or not there was brain damage from Dr. Dean. While she may have said early on, you know, it might be a good idea to get a neuropsychologist, that her final report would have countered that recommendation.
Well, Your Honor, if you go to your primary care physician and you say, I've got chest pains, and they say, well, you need to go to a cardiologist, but I've got this stethoscope and I'll listen. They don't hear anything, you would still go to your cardiologist to look to see if there was something wrong with your heart. You wouldn't rely on somebody who does not have the expertise necessary. When your doctor says, go get somebody who has the proper expertise to look at your heart.
Judge Fisher asked the question whether it was in the record that she had the expertise to perform any or all of the 15 objective tests that were later performed. Is there anything in the record regarding that?
There is nothing in the record regarding that. But the fact of the matter is, she is not a trained neuropsychologist. She told them she was not a trained neuropsychologist. She told them, you need to do this. Johnny failed the Stroop test. And everything pointed toward, go get a neuropsychologist. This jury heard only half of the story, the mental disease. There was nothing about the mental defect. And to say now that we have to bring in two neuropsychologists is ridiculous.
Thank you
Please
very
don't
much.
Kill Johnny.
Any
Thank
more
you.
Questions? The case will be taken under submission and the court will be in recess.